Welcome to the Southward Poetry Podcast. I am your host, Sarah Byrne. Today's guest is Paul Muldoon. Paul is the author of 14 collections of poetry, including Moy Sand and Gravel, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize in 2003. Paul's most recent collection is Howley Skelp, published by Faber in 2021. Paul was appointed the Ireland Professor of Poetry, taking over from Frank Ormsby in November 2022.
Truth is that for most of us, all the work goes into making it look as if it came very quickly and very naturally. So the work has to go into it. At least for me, it does. There are probably some writers who find it easy to write, but I'm not one of them. It takes me forever to write a sentence. Banisters. Are ornamental gates and railings that were melted down for rifle barrels have gained some sort of posthumous renown by unambiguously drawing a line in the sand. The gates and railings are finally taking a firm stand and even more emphatically bringing things to a close. The exit wound is their approximation of a rose or a geranium under gauze on the windowsill. Gangrene, the green and gold of the first full-blown daffodil. Also rendered, so it would even more tellingly rend, was lead stripped from the gutters and flashing. For lead will bend along a spine as it did along a walnut ridge post. What was once an outer sanctum is now the innermost. Shouldered as rifle stocks, after a mere 3 weeks of drill, the banisters are gradually taking another hill.
Great, Paul. Thank you so much. I wanted, I suppose, to ask you about what a reader, and you as a reader as well, brings to a word. Banister in the Republic of Ireland is usually inside the house, right? It's the top of the stairs in a domestic setting. And the banister you're evoking here is a public railing, is that right?
No, I think of it as being inside the house, so that the banister within the house is being used. It's made of a heavy wood, a hard wood, and it's being repurposed as a rifle stock. It is true that the poem is kind of moving between the inner and outer. And in fact, it makes some play of that with the inner and outer sanctum. But no, the banister itself is on the stairs within the house.
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that. I read when I was doing research, I had read that in British English, so in England and Wales, a banister was a metal railing outside.
Well, it's true that there are references to the railings outside the house, right, which were indeed melted down. I think, funnily enough, primarily during the Second World War, after the development of oxyacetylene. But they probably had ways of cutting them down in the First World War. In any case, the idea is that these, everyday items are repurposed for war, for this problematic aspect of our lives. At least we assume it's problematic. I mean, it may be problematic, but it's certainly very common at the same time.
I love that you use the word repurpose. Is that what's happening in a poem? Do you think it's a repurpose? Maybe look at the banister. I suppose I think of how it's a theme that must have occupied your own personal and poetic life. Being from Armagh, I know you mentioned the daffodil and the tricolour and this alchemy between, I suppose, beauty and violence not being exactly steady thing.
Oh, you see the green and the gold as the tricolour?
I did. I picked it up like that. Yeah. Uh-huh. Maybe it comes back to my initial thing about readerly presumptions. Maybe it comes back to what we actually bring to a word.
We bring a lot, but we actually have to figure out what it's trying to do. You know, we have a tendency to read the poem that we want to read rather than the poem that is actually staring us in the face. But repurposing, certainly there are some poems, I'm sure, that, in Frost's famous phrase, that are in conversation with all other poems, he would say, in verse and prose ever written. So in that sense, there's very little new under the sun. In Gangrene, for me, actually, I can only ever think of Gangrene without thinking of a poem by Joseph Brodsky. But at the same time, I have to put it out of my mind because this poem is a different poem. And you know, ideally, this poem, while it may share aspects of, we may recognize aspects of it from other poems we've read, we also have to, I think, hope for, insofar as we have any rights to hope for anything, a poem unlike anything we've quite seen before. And that's what makes them hard to read in many ways, you know.
Would you say it's what makes them hard to write as well?
I mean, they are hard to write. That's absolutely the case. So it's a complex business because, as I think it's Keats who says, if a poem does not come as naturally as leaves to a tree, it had better not come at all. The way I read that is that it perhaps might look or should look as if it came very naturally. Mm. Truth is that for most of us, all the work goes into making it look as if it came very quickly and very naturally. So the work has to go into it, at least for me it does. There are probably some writers who find it easy to write, but I'm not one of them. It takes me forever to write a sentence. The challenge, I think, is to write something not at all like anything we've seen before. I myself, as a poet, have no interest in it if it looks anything much like anything we've seen before, either as a writer or a reader. A ruin. It might have been a grist mill, a dilapidated granary or grange I first drove by some 60 years ago, and with my little eye espied through a door frame the tousled ferns and red-haired dachshunds of kids my own age sent out to play in the snow. Their snowballs so specific in the sprawl. Windowless now, roofless, tucked under the first sheltering hill of a range that ran all the way to Mexico, a country into which we still hoped to ride hell for leather, still hoped to adjourn after the stick-up. This ruin betokens not only the slow-mowing of a meadow for a shopping mall, but the fate that would befall the many tagged and re-tagged over those 60 years. The landscape is so marked by change. The bungled peace process, the shoddy bungalows, the wind farms taking us in their stride. So marked by all the turns things have indeed taken for kids now summoned back from playing in the snow. The nettles almost as tall as its dividing wall. A ruin seems the only thing intact.
I wanted to talk to you about that pledge to mystery that a poem can be and a poet can be, and your own relationship with sort of uncertainty over your career. Like, it's been an incredibly illustrious, award-winning career. And yet the craft is probably building on what I just mentioned. The craft itself is so uncertain and precarious.
It does come from a mysterious place. It's hard to account for why they come into the world, except perhaps by virtue of their own needs and their own whatever impels them or compels them to be in the world and to use us as vehicles for their being in the world. In general, though, I don't begin with a notion of mystery. I begin by trying to be clear. And I mean, I think often, however clear we might be, however clear any aspect of the world might be, there's still a mysterious aspect to it. But in other words, I'm not trying to inject mystery into anything, not trying to inject difficulty into anything. Though I think by virtue of the very nature of the world, there is difficulty and mystery intrinsic to it.
So I was going to invite you to read the poem you wrote about Oscar Wilde.
Oh, I love Oscar Wilde. I mean, that story of his meeting the customs and excise man on his way into the U.S. And having nothing to declare, or was it nothing to declare? Who knows? But his genius. I think he's one of the few. One of the few-ish people, you know, of whom it might appropriately be said that they are geniuses. I mean, I wonder if he ever said anything that wasn't terribly funny. I mean, he probably couldn't say good morning without being funny or witty in some way, which actually must have been a terrible burden for him.
Mm.
You know, I mean, we know in our own lives people who, well, even comedians. I know a few comedians in the strictest sense, in the sense that that's their profession, as well as in the everyday sense of people who are comedians without necessarily setting out to be. I know that for professional comedians, they feel some pressure to be funny, and I think it's very difficult for them to kind of be funny as a matter of course. But for Oscar, I think probably it came quite naturally to him. In any case, one of the places I spent some time is at the village of Sharon Springs in New York State. And Sharon Springs is an old spa town, which was very popular in 1882, for example, August 12th, I think it was, of that year, when Oscar Wilde was on his big 18-month-long American tour, and he showed up in the Pavilion Hotel, remnants of which are, well, the kind of the foundations of which are still standing, to give his talk on the decorative arts. But anyway, I wrote this poem about Oscar. He was still only a kid, but he was already quite famous, I suppose. Oscar Wilde at the Pavilion Hotel, as he holds forth on the subject of the decorative arts, the smell of Brimstone Creek conveys him to that realm of le désespoir, in which the flesh is willing, but the spirit weak. Since he waltzed off the ship in January, this trip has already seen him lounging in so many far-flung parts to offer his critique of that which hallows the vessels of everyday use. The very horsehair couch now longs to be released from the burden of its being. He won't quite vouch for his own being in the grip of a rose-hipped angel in the front row who seems to overly wrestle with his meaning. Yet Oscar senses they might yet crouch in a river fault, overwhelmed by the same purple loose strife as stowed away in the Arizona's ballast. A deckhand has been known to find beauty in a butter knife, and a hulking Chinese navvy to sip tea from a bone china lip. Back in London, all the while, a pillar of salt is turning into the woman who'll shortly become his wife.
I wanted to ask you, baby, a little bit a different part of your career, but to do with Oscar Wilde. and the sort of the carnivalesque or the funnier parts of life, in the sense of your involvement with the picnic that you organise. Did that evolve out of you appearing at Electric Picnic and then you went on to create Muldoon's Picnic?
No, it's, well, I have been at the Electric Picnic for sure. I think, funnily enough, it's more likely that the Electric Picnic derives from a broader notion of the picnic as a jamboree. Certainly in the case of Muldoon's Picnic, was a very popular attraction in New York, actually not long after Oscar Wilde was upstate. And certainly in the 1890s, there were two competing versions of Muldoon's Picnic. So it was a variety show. I like to think of it is probably as a version of something along the lines of Sunday Night at the London Palladium, where they would have had various acts lined up. So it was with that in mind that that I thought it would be fun to revive the idea of an evening in New York that had music and poetry and fiction. So that's basically where it started. And I mean, there's nothing new about it, really. It's a form of entertainment that has been popular for as long as we've been gathering round fires and amusing ourselves. So the picnic has been running mostly at the Irish Arts Centre in New York. But then, of course, we've done it in various parts of the world, including, as you say, in Ireland.
Yeah. And you're still involved in Eterna Tara as well?
I still am. Yeah, that's something that started running around about the time of the M3 debacle or whatever. I mean, I don't know. Was it a debacle? I'm on that road now. There's nobody much on that road, so far as I could see. You know, I suppose at the time, some of us were concerned about the impact of building that road on the historical richness of that area. I mean, the counter argument to that, of course, is that there isn't a square mile of Ireland that isn't archaeologically coming down with riches of all kind. But we set out, however many years ago that is now, to honour the memory of Tara as a place where music and recitation would also have taken place. So we still run Eterna Tara, Feis Charu. That's still going.
You're obviously in the States since the late 80s, and I was just thinking of the Irish sort of impulse to agitate through kind of the crack, you know, to sort of somehow disrupt through fun or being funny or humour or, you know. Wondering, do you have that impulse? I mean, I obviously pick it up in your poems, the playfulness, but also do you have that inner crack still that you carry around as someone who comes from this island?
I think so. I mean, I do think that humour is a very powerful tool. I mean, and we know that in our day-to-day lives, when something troubling happens to us, and when there's a death in the family, for example, I mean, perversely, paradoxically, one of the ways we deal with that is to not make light of it necessarily, but we tend to find the humour in the darkest and most difficult situations. And I think it's one of the ways, as a species, we've learned to adapt to distress and danger. I think it's really hardwired into us. And I mean, as you know, there's almost no distinction between laughing and crying. In fact, the two are, in many cases, indistinguishable from afar or even from up close. I mean, certainly in my own case, a lot of my poems do have a humorous aspect, I mean, there are those who, for some reason, feel that humour and poetry don't quite go together.
Mm.
Humour doesn't quite belong in serious poetry. I'm not quite sure where they got that idea, but good luck to them. Just to pick up on what you say about humour, I mean, this is a poem which at least is attempting, I think, to be humorous. Whether or not it entirely succeeds, I don't know. But it's a poem that began just with watching a wave or successive waves coming in and detecting in them, you know, that little curl of the lip, almost a sneer that one associates with Elvis Presley. He had a very particular way of presenting his lip to the world. So it started with that. And anyway, so I'll finish with that. And
wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it. A postcard from St. Bart's. An Elvis impersonator curling his lip as he limbers up for return to sender. A wave may develop that slight curling of the lip till it becomes a sneer. Not that a wave may more than slightly develop. The character of snare becomes a sneer no less than Master Fang. The character of snare being in a funk no less than his buddy, Master Fang. Pretending to be a havoc wreaker while being in a blue funk is pretty much de rigueur, since your typical havoc wreaker doesn't have the chops. It's pretty much de rigueur for the sea to take out a few ships unless it doesn't have the chops, unless it can't rise to the occasion. For a self-respecting sea to take out a few ships is a sine qua non, just as being confident he'll rise to the occasion while limbering up for return to sender is a sine qua non for the white-pearled Elvis impersonator.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you so much.
My name is Amy Woolard, and I'll be reading the poem Last from Southward, issue 43. Last. Our love loves the same way news must feel when it travels. In the South, it's not the heat, it's the leaving each other, infinitum, how the bed is undone as my witched hair, how the morning presses its palm into my palm while I watch you dress. How you deadline the door, hold your face like a drink you ordered, though you weren't thirsty. It's the humidity of not touching. When I tell you I miss you, what I'm really saying is, I hope my sister never dies. An absence of evidence rather than evidence of absence. Dear last love, the afterword is already now. Each morning, a new same hits home. Days go by like the past owners of a house circling the old neighborhood. There is no azalea, no blue pickup, no glass door corsaged with light. With our hands, we cover our mouths to keep the lungs from leaving us when a sorrow hits them. Like sorrows, there are more cardinals than trees to hold them close, but still they stay. It's the leaving each other alone. I'm saying it's how a body can be had. With our hands, we tuck back the impossible, falling long across our faces. We palm the soft dog's softer ears so we can better dream of them when they're gone.
Complimentary copies of the featured book and subscriptions to Southward are on offer for what we judge to be the best listener reviews posted on iTunes and Spotify in the 6 weeks following each episode release. Maybe you already have the book and a Southward subscription. We'd be pleased for you to review us anyway. Reviews increase the visibility and listenership of the series. The Southward Poetry Podcast is produced by the Munster Literature Centre and presented by Sarah Byrne. The music is by Jake Koza. The poets for the 2022 season were selected by Sarah Byrne, Patrick Cotter and James O'Leary. The Munster Literature Centre is a grateful recipient of funding from the Arts Council of Ireland and the Arts Office of Cork City Council.